Understanding the two general types of servo mechanisms. Servo mechanisms are divided into two general types. One, where the target, goal, or answer is known and the objective is to reach it or accomplish it. Two, where the target or answer is not known and the objective is to discover or locate it. The human brain and nervous system operate in both ways. An example of the first type is the self-guided torpedo or the interceptor missile. The target or goal is known. An enemy ship or plane. The objective is to reach it. Such machines must know the target they are shooting for. They must have some sort of propulsion system that propels them forward in the general direction of the target. They must be equipped with sense organs, radar, sonar, heat perceptors, etc., which bring information from the target. These sense organs keep the machine informed when it is on the correct course, positive feedback, and when it commits an error and gets off course, negative feedback. The machine does not react or respond to positive feedback. It is doing the correct thing already and just keeps on doing what it is doing. There must be a corrective device, however, that responds to negative feedback. When negative feedback informs the mechanism that it is off the beam, for example, too far to the right, the corrective mechanism automatically causes the rudder to move so that it will steer the machine back to the left. If it overcorrects and heads too far to the left, this mistake is made known through negative feedback, and the corrective device moves the rudder so it steers the machine back to the right. The torpedo accomplishes its goal by going forward, making errors, and continually correcting them. By a series of zigzags, it literally gropes its way to the goal. Dr. Norbert Wiener, who pioneered the development of goal-seeking mechanisms in World War II, believes that something very similar to the foregoing happens in the human nervous system whenever you perform any purposeful activity. Even in such a simple goal-seeking situation, as picking up a pencil from a table. We are able to accomplish the goal of picking up the pencil because of an automatic mechanism, not by will or conscious thinking alone. All that the conscious thought does is to select the goal, trigger it into action by desire, and feed information to the automatic mechanism so that your hand continually corrects its course. In the first place, said Dr. Wiener, only an anatomist would know all the muscles involved in picking up the pencil, and if you knew, you would not consciously say to yourself, I must contract my shoulder muscles to elevate my arm. Now I must contract my triceps to extend my arm, etc. You just go ahead and pick up the pencil, and are not conscious of issuing orders to individual muscles, nor of computing just how much contraction is needed. When you select the goal and trigger it into action, an automatic mechanism takes over. First of all, you have picked up a pencil or performed similar movements before. Your automatic mechanism has learned something of the correct response needed. Next, your automatic mechanism uses feedback data furnished to the brain by your eyes, which tell it the degree to which the pencil is not picked up. This feedback data enables the automatic mechanism to continually correct the motion of your hand until it is steered to the pencil. Picking up a pencil probably isn't very exciting, but it should be, because the little process just described that we use to pick up a pencil or perform any number of other routine, unchallenging tasks is exactly the same process we can use to achieve much more complex and seemingly challenging goals. What's exciting is that you own the process and use it constantly. No new goal-achieving capabilities are needed, and none are lacking. In other words, if you can pick up a pencil, you can speak confidently and persuasively to large audiences, or write compelling advertising, or start a business, or play golf, or you name it. You already own the process. In a baby just learning to use its muscles, the correction of the hand in reaching for a rattle is very obvious. The baby has little stored information to draw upon. Its hand zigzags back and forth and gropes obviously as it reaches. As learning takes place, correction becomes more and more refined. We see this in a person just learning to drive a car, who overcorrects and zigzags back and forth across the street. Once, however, a correct or successful response has been accomplished, it is remembered for future use. The automatic mechanism then duplicates this successful response on future trials. It has learned how to respond successfully. It remembers its successes, forgets its failures, and repeats the successful action as a habit. This is why the most adept, successful achievers in different fields appear to be succeeding so effortlessly. Top-performing sales professionals respond to prospects' objections or concerns without missing a beat, say just the right thing at just the right time. Their responses have become habits, instinctive in a way. You already have reached this point with any number of things you do well. This fact that you have done so guarantees that you can do so again for any other purpose you choose. How your brain finds answers to problems. Let's return to our examination of the process. Now let us suppose that the room is dark so that you cannot see the pencil. You know or hope there's a pencil on the table, along with a variety of other objects. Instinctively, your hand begins to grope back and forth, performing zigzag motions, or scanning, rejecting one object after another until the pencil is found and recognized. This is an example of the second type of servo mechanism. Recalling a name temporarily forgotten is another example. A scanner in your brain roams through your stored memories until the correct name is recognized. An electronic brain solves problems in much the same way. First, a great deal of data must be fed into the machine. This stored or recorded information is the machine's memory. A problem is posed to the machine. It scans back through its memory until it locates the only answer that is consistent with and meets all the conditions of the problem. Problem and answer together constitute a whole situation or structure. When part of the situation or structure, the problem, is given to the machine, it locates the only missing parts, or the right size brick, so to speak, to complete the structure. You are familiar with this in search engines on the internet and search functions within computer software. The earliest versions of these in computers were relatively slow, awkward, and inefficient. Today's versions are lightning fast by comparison, but still very limited in scope and power if compared to the equivalent search engine included in your own mind. People who become very committed practitioners of psychocybernetics get very, very good at using their internal search engines. Many writers and speakers, for example, tell me of giving their subconscious instructions about their need for a good anecdote, story, joke, or forgotten details of a story for a writing task or speech, then taking a nap to awake with exactly the material they wanted on their minds. A look at the automatic mechanism in action. We marvel at the awesomeness of interceptor missiles that can compute in a flash the point of interception of another missile and be there at the correct instant to make contact. The smart bombs we witnessed during the Desert Storm conflict utilized technology of this kind. Today's technology is far superior to what guided torpedoes in World War II submarines, and it is arguably possible for the so-called Star Wars defense system advocated by President Reagan to eventually become a reality. Yet are we not witnessing something just as amazing each time we see a center fielder catch a fly ball? To compute where the ball will fall, or where the point of interception will be, he must take into account the speed of the ball, its curvature of fall, its direction, windage, initial velocity, and the rate of progressive decrease in velocity. He must compute just how fast he must run and in what direction in order to arrive at the point of interception at the same time or before the ball does. The center fielder doesn't even think about this. His built-in goal-striving mechanism computes it for him from data that he feeds it through his eyes and ears. The computer in his brain takes this information, compares it with stored data, memories of other successes and failures in catching fly balls. All necessary computations are made in a flash, and orders are issued to his leg muscles, and he just runs. Science can build the computer, but not the operator. Dr. Viner said that at no time in the foreseeable future will scientists be able to construct an electronic brain anywhere near comparable to the human brain. He says, "I think that our gadget-conscious public has shown an unawareness of the special advantages and special disadvantages of electronic machinery as compared with the human brain. The number of switching devices in the human brain vastly exceeds the number in any computing machine yet developed or even thought of for design in the near future." Unquote. His prophecy remains true as of this writing. To be sure, many miraculous computer-type machines and gadgets have come into our hands since Dr. Viner first tinkered with cybernetics. What once consumed rooms of space now fits in a hard drive that sits on your desktop. Still, nothing compares with your system of imagination, self-image, servo mechanism. But even should such a computer be built, it would lack a programmer. A computer cannot pose problems to itself. It has no imagination and cannot set goals for itself. It cannot determine which goals are worthwhile and which are not. It has no emotions. It cannot feel. It works only on new data fed to it by an operator. By feedback data, it secures from its own sense organs and from information previously stored. Are you connected to an infinite storehouse of ideas, knowledge, and power? Many great thinkers of all ages have believed that a human being's stored information is not limited to personal memories of past experiences and learned facts. There is one mind common to all individual men, said Emerson, who compared our individual minds to the inlets in an ocean of universal mind. Thomas Edison believed that he got some of his ideas from a source outside himself. Once, when complimented for a creative idea, he disclaimed credit, saying that ideas are in the air, and if he had not discovered it, someone else would have. Dr. J.B. Rhine, once head of Duke University's parapsychology laboratory, has proved experimentally that people have access to knowledge, facts, and ideas other than their own individual memories or stored information from learning or experience. Telepathy, clairvoyance, and precognition have been established by countless scientific laboratory experiments. Our government, the Russian government, and other nations have quietly invested huge sums and many years of ongoing research into such matters. In recent years, people have brought these subjects to the public more as entertainment than science, such as Uri Geller or the amazing Kreskin. While much of what passes for telepathy in magicians' and mentalists' stage performances is nothing but trickery, both Geller and Kreskin have had their abilities documented in laboratory settings. Kreskin himself insists that everybody possesses the same abilities as he does. The difference is in development and use. I am admittedly more interested in the thinking of a Thomas Edison than a Kreskin on this, but if you look at the entire span of research and relevant writings from the 1920s to the present, you'll find one common thread of great potential use to you and directly related to psychocybernetics. You can give problem-solving or idea-getting tasks to your servo mechanism. Send it off on a search while you do other things, even while you sleep, and have it return with useful material you didn't know you knew and might never have obtained through conscious thought or worry. This becomes a common experience and great benefit for those of us who regularly rely on psychocybernetics. It occurs because the servo mechanism has access to a much more expansive storehouse of information than the conscious mind. The famous composer Schubert is said to have told a friend that his own creative process consisted in remembering a melody that neither he nor anyone else had ever thought of before. Many creative artists, as well as psychologists who have made a study of the creative process, have been impressed by the similarity between creative inspiration, sudden revelation or intuition, and ordinary human memory. Searching for a new idea or an answer to a problem is in fact very similar to searching memory for a name you have forgotten. You know that the name is there, or else you would not search. The scanner in your brain scans back over stored memories until the desired name is recognized or discovered. The answer exists now. In much the same way, when we set out to find a new idea or the answer to a problem, we must assume that the answer exists already somewhere and set out to find it. In The Human Use of Human Beings, Dr. Norbert Wiener wrote, "Once a scientist attacks a problem which he knows to have an answer, his entire attitude is changed. He is already some 50% of his way toward that answer." Unquote. When you set out to do creative work, whether in selling, managing a business, writing a sonnet, improving human relations, or whatever, you begin with a goal in mind, an end to be achieved, a target answer, which, although perhaps somewhat vague, will be recognized when achieved. If you really mean business, have an intense desire, and begin to think intensely about all angles of the problem, your creative mechanism goes to work. And the scanner we spoke of earlier scans back through stored information or gropes its way to an answer. It selects an idea here, a fact there, a series of former experiences, and relates them or ties them together into a meaningful whole that will fill out the incomplete portion of your situation, complete your equation, or solve your problem. When this solution is served up to your consciousness, often at an unguarded moment when you are thinking of something else, or perhaps even as a dream while your consciousness is asleep, Something clicks, and you at once recognize this as the answer you have been searching for. In this process, does your creative mechanism also have access to stored information in a universal mind? Numerous experiences of creative workers would seem to indicate that it does. How else, for example, can you explain the experience of Louis Agassiz, told by his wife? He had been striving to decipher the somewhat obscure impression of a fossil fish on the stone slab in which it was preserved. Weary and perplexed, he put his work aside at last and tried to dismiss it from his mind. Shortly after, he waked one night persuaded that while asleep he had seen his fish with all the missing features perfectly restored. He went early to the Jardin des Plantes, thinking that on looking anew at the impression he would see something to put him on the track of his vision. In vain. The blurred record was as blank as ever. The next night, he saw the fish again, but when he waked it disappeared from his memory as before. Hoping the same experience might be repeated, on the third night he placed a pencil and paper beside his bed before going to sleep. Towards morning, the fish reappeared in his dream, confusedly at first, but at last with such distinctness that he no longer had any doubt as to its zoological characteristics. Still half-dreaming, in perfect darkness, he traced these characters on the sheet of paper at the bedside. In the morning he was surprised to see, in his nocturnal sketch, features which he thought it impossible the fossil itself would reveal. He hastened to the Jardin des Plantes, and with his drawing as a guide, succeeded in chiseling away the surface of the stone under which portions of the fish proved to be hidden. When wholly exposed, the fossil corresponded with his dream and his drawing, and he succeeded in classifying it with ease. You're no Einstein. Sometimes a parent or teacher, frustrated at a young person's seeming inability to grasp mathematics, will utter the critical, disparaging, negative affirmation, "He's no Einstein," walking away in disappointment and frustration. Well, it turns out that Einstein was no Einstein either. In the book Sparks of Genius, researchers and authors Robert and Michelle Root Bernstein disclose that Einstein's peers knew that Einstein was relatively weak in mathematics, often needing the assistance of mathematicians to do the detail work to push his ideas forward. Einstein wrote to one such person, "Do not worry about your difficulties in mathematics. I can assure you that mine are far greater." Much of Einstein's celebrated success came about in his imagination, in very unscience-like ways. He once described an experiment in which he imagined himself to be a photon moving at the speed of light, imagined what he as a photon saw and felt, then imagined himself as a second photon pursuing the first. What kind of scientific experimentation is this? Where is the blackboard filled with chalky logarithms and formulas we typically associate with Einstein? My own analysis of everything I've read about Albert Einstein is that he was a great practitioner of psychocybernetics. He acted as if a theoretical idea was a factual conclusion, then turned the figuring out over to his own servo mechanism, as well as to other worker bees. I am convinced he connected with intelligence outside the realm of his own stored data through his imagination. He was a brilliant target setter. His accomplishments stand as testament to an individual's opportunity to rise above and beyond his or her stored knowledge, education, experience, or skill through the power of imagination. You can too. So what exactly is psychocybernetics? You might think of psychocybernetics as a collection of insights, principles, and practical methods that enable you to do all of the following. 1. Conduct an accurate inventory and analysis of the contents of your self-image. 2. Identify erroneous and restrictive programming embedded in your self-image and systematically alter it to better suit your purposes. 3. Use your imagination to reprogram and manage your self-image. 4. Use your imagination in concert with your self-image to effectively communicate with your servo mechanism so that it acts as an automatic success mechanism, moving you steadily towards your goals, including getting back on course when confronted with obstacles. 5. Effectively use your servo mechanism as something like a giant search engine to provide precisely the idea, information, or solution you need for any particular purpose, even reaching beyond your own stored data to obtain it. In a way, psychocybernetics is a communication system for effectively communicating with yourself. get a new mental picture of yourself. The unhappy failure-type personality cannot develop a new self-image by pure willpower or by arbitrarily deciding to. There must be some ground, some justification, some reason for deciding that the old picture of self is in error and that a new picture is appropriate. You cannot merely imagine a new self-image unless you feel that it is based upon truth. Experience has shown that when people change their self-image, they have the feeling that, for one reason or another, they see or realize the truth about themselves. The truth in this chapter can set you free of an old, inadequate self-image. If you listen to it often, think intently about the implications, and hammer home its truths to yourself. In her book Revolution from Within, A Book of Self-Esteem, Gloria Steinem tells the story of the Royal Knights of Spanish Harlem, a prize-winning championship school chess club improbably made up of a dozen toughs from Spanish Harlem. These kids were hanging out on the street, engaging in minor crime and violence, one foot mired in delinquency, experimenting with drugs. Most people who observed them quickly concluded they were useless, hopeless, dangerous, very unlikely to achieve anything much beyond a jail sentence, and unworthy of any investment. But Bill Hall, an ordinary schoolteacher, somehow saw potential here that no one else could see. And through the activity of a chess club, he engineered an environment and a series of experiences that changed the way these kids saw themselves. Quite often, a person voted unlikely to succeed by others and by him or herself fortunately encounters someone who sees a potential no one else sees, believes in him far more than he does in himself, and literally directs a change in that person's self-image through a determined influence. However, there is no need to wait for someone else to do this for you. You can do it for yourself with psychocybernetics. And as you'll discover in this program, thousands have. The fundamental message of psychocybernetics is that every human being has been literally engineered for success by the Creator. Every human being has access to a power greater than him or herself. This means you. If you were engineered for success and happiness, then any old picture of yourself as unworthy of happiness, or inherently unable to excel in a certain aspect of life, of a person who was meant to fail, must be in error. Here's a prescription to help you along. Listen to this chapter at least 3 times per week for the first 21 days. Study it and digest it. Listen for examples in your experiences and in the experiences of your friends that illustrate the creative mechanism in action. Think about limiting ideas about yourself that may be held firmly in the self-image, that may be the cause of effects you no longer desire. Try this mental training exercise. Memorize the following basic principles by which your success mechanism operates. You do not need to be a computer genius or a neurophysicist to operate your own servo mechanism, any more than you have to be able to engineer an automobile in order to drive one, or become an electrical engineer in order to turn on the light in your room. You do need to be familiar with the following, however, because having memorized these points, they will throw new light on what is to follow. 1. Aim. Your built-in success mechanism must have a goal or target. This goal or target must be conceived of as already in existence now, either in actual or potential form. It operates either 1. By steering you to a goal already in existence, or 2. By discovering something already in existence. 2. Trust. The automatic mechanism is teleological, that is, it operates on or must be oriented to end results or goals. Do not be discouraged because the means may not be apparent. It is the function of the automatic mechanism to supply the means when you supply the goal. Think in terms of the end result, and the means will often take care of themselves. 3. Relax. Do not be afraid of making mistakes or of temporary failures. All servo mechanisms achieve a goal by negative feedback, or by going forward, making mistakes, and immediately correcting course. Automatic course correction is one of the many benefits of psychocybernetics. 4. Learn. Skill learning of any kind is accomplished by trial and error, mentally correcting your aim after an error until you achieve a successful motion, movement, or performance. After that, further learning and continued success are accomplished by forgetting the past errors and remembering the successful response so that it can be imitated. 5. Do. You must learn to trust your creative mechanism to do its work and not jam it by becoming too concerned or too anxious as to whether it will work or not, or by attempting to force it by too much conscious effort. You must let it work rather than make it work. This trust is necessary because your creative mechanism operates below the level of consciousness, and you cannot know what is going on beneath the surface. Moreover, its nature is to operate spontaneously according to the present need. Therefore, you have no guarantees in advance. It comes into operation as you act, and as you place a demand on it by your actions. You must not wait to act until you have proof. You must act as if it is there, and it will come through. Do the thing, and you will have the power, said Emerson. With all this in mind, select a target, whether it is that thinner, healthier you, a more confident, persuasive you, a you free of constant worry, a sales professional free of procrastination who begins each day with an organized to-do list and ends each day with it completed, or a golfer who hits perfectly straight drives. Devote just 10 or 15 minutes every day to taking that mental picture from a vague idea to a good sketch to a finely detailed, fully fleshed out and colored vision that occurs to you exactly the same way whenever called upon. If it helps to write out descriptions or to draw illustrations on paper or to collect relevant pictures from magazines, do so. Just stick to 10 or 15 minute sessions when you close your eyes to the outer world and open them only to this picture's continuing development. Try this little experiment for 21 days and see what happens. The Strengthened and Empowered Automatic Success Mechanism. You accelerate personal development and goal achievement by providing your ASM with a clear, precisely detailed, vividly imagined, and perfectly communicated target. As the target gets clearer, the ASM responds by doing its job more efficiently. Chapter 3. Imagination, the ignition key to your automatic success mechanism. Industrialist Charles M. Schwab wrote, "To carry on a successful business, a man must have imagination. He must see things as in a vision, a dream of the whole thing." Imagination plays a far more important role in our lives than most of us realize. I have seen this demonstrated many times in my practice. A particularly memorable instance concerned a patient who was literally forced to visit my office by his family. He was a man of about 40, unmarried, who held down a routine job during the day and kept to himself in his apartment when the workday was over, never going anywhere, never doing anything. He'd had many such jobs and never seemed able to stay with any of them for any great length of time. His problem was that he had a rather large nose and ears that protruded a little more than normal. He considered himself ugly and funny-looking. He imagined that the people he came into contact with during the day were laughing at him and talking about him behind his back because he was so odd. His imaginings grew so strong that he actually feared going out into the business world and moving among people. He hardly felt safe, even in his own home. The poor man even imagined that his family was ashamed of him because he was peculiar-looking, not like other people. Actually, his facial deficiencies were not serious. His nose was of the classical Roman type, and his ears, though somewhat large, attracted no more attention than those of thousands of people with similar ears. In desperation, his family brought him to see me to see if I could help him. I saw that he did not need surgery, only an understanding of the fact that his imagination had wrought such havoc with his self-image that he had lost sight of the truth. He was not really ugly. People did not consider him odd and laugh at him because of his appearance. His imagination alone was responsible for his misery. His imagination had set up an automatic negative failure mechanism within him, and it was operating full blast to his extreme misfortune. Fortunately, after several sessions with him, and with the help of his family, he was able gradually to realize that the power of his own imagination was responsible for his plight, and he succeeded in building up a true self-image and achieving the confidence he needed by applying creative imagination rather than destructive imagination. You might say he needed emotional surgery, not physical surgery, with an actual scalpel. In the latter years of my surgical practice, I became quite skilled at talking myself out of business. This is an analogy for the experiences of thousands of people, quite possibly in one way or another, including you. No, you may not feel ashamed of your nose or ears or any other physical feature, and you may not be a recluse, But many people believe there is something about them that causes others to look down on them, to ridicule them behind their backs, to reject them, something that prevents them from progressing in certain ways. One of the smartest, most successful, and prolific idea men I've ever known in the advertising field has had a lifelong pattern of rising to high income, then suddenly experiencing circumstances that pull the rug out from under him, so that he must rebuild from scratch his reputation and his finances. One month he was living in a mansion, the next in a motel. He has admitted to me and to others that he has spent his entire life trying to escape the iron-fisted grip of what he calls his white trash ancestry, and to paraphrase Al Pacino in one of the Godfather movies, just as he gets out, he is again pulled back. Of course, this thing that keeps pulling him back does not exist in the physical world, only inside his own self-image. It's his ugly nose and big ears. What's yours? Ironically, even though his entire business is the imagination business, he has yet to discover how to use his imagination as a scalpel in emotional surgery to rid his self-image of its big nose. Creative imagination is not something reserved for the poets, the philosophers, the inventors. It enters into our every act. Imagination sets the goal picture that our automatic mechanism works on. We act or fail to act not because of will, as is so commonly believed, but because of imagination. This is the most important statement to be gleaned from this entire program. Human beings always act and feel and perform in accordance with what they imagine to be true about themselves and their environment. You cannot long escape or outperform that picture. You can dissect it, analyze it, uncover what is in it that is not true about yourself, and alter it. You can modify it without archaeological examination of the past, but you cannot escape it. You will always act and perform and experience appropriate results in accordance with what you imagine to be true about yourself and your environment. This is a basic and fundamental law of mind. It is the way we are built. When we see this law of mind graphically and dramatically demonstrated in a hypnotized subject, we are prone to think that there is something occult or supernormal at work, or to discredit it as simple stage illusion. Actually, what we are witnessing often is the normal operating process of the human brain and nervous system. For example, if a good hypnotic subject is told that she is at the North Pole, she will not only shiver and appear to be cold, her body will react just as if she were cold, and goose pimples will develop. The same phenomena have been demonstrated on wide-awake college students by asking them to imagine that one hand is immersed in ice water. Thermometer readings show that the temperature drops in the treated hand. Tell a hypnotized subject that your finger is a red-hot poker, and he will not only grimace with pain at your touch, but his cardiovascular and lymphatic systems will react just as if your finger were a red-hot poker and produce inflammation and perhaps a blister on the skin. In one demonstration, when college students, wide awake, have been told to imagine that a spot on their foreheads was hot, temperature readings documented an actual increase in skin temperature. These are elementary experiments just one step away from the rather cruel but common children's game, the practical joke played at school, and sometimes by adults at work. In this prank, a person is secretly targeted by the group. Then one person after another engages the target in conversation, asking, "Aren't you feeling well, Bob? You look pretty white-faced. Bob, are you feeling all right?" Soon, poor Bob is in the restroom checking himself out in the mirror. Before long, Bob is feeling queasy and weak. Bob may even actually become so sick he must lie down or go home. Your nervous system cannot tell the difference between an imagined experience and a real one. Your nervous system reacts appropriately to what you think or imagine to be true. This phenomenon that can be produced as a practical joke or by a hypnotist on stage for entertainment is actually identical to, or illustrative of, the basic process that governs much of our behavior and that can be taken hold of and deliberately used to advantage. How the hypnotic power of negative imagination can be a fatal disease. When I wrote my book for physicians in 1936, New Faces, New Futures, about the impact of plastic surgery on personality, I reprinted in it a newspaper article from a St. Louis newspaper headlined, "Inferiority Complex Caused by Long Nose Drives College Student to Commit Suicide." This article reported the suicide of a 24-year-old student of Washington University named Theodore Hoffman. Ironically, the article reported that those who knew him considered him popular. Here is the text of this young man's suicide note. Quote, "To the world. When I was a child, other children abused and mistreated me because I was weaker and uglier than they. I was a sensitive, bashful boy, and was teased because of my face and long nose. The more they offended me, the more they teased. I became afraid of people. I knew that many of them hated me for things that I was not responsible for, my sentimental nature, and my appearance. I was unable to speak to anyone. My confidence was gone. A teacher spelled my name with two F's, although it has only one. Yet I became so backward I was unable to correct her, and therefore spelled it with two F's throughout my school career. God forgive everyone for this. I am afraid of the world, but I'm not afraid to die." Unquote. At the time, a professor at the university judged this to be the most severe case of an inferiority complex ever known. Nonsense. Believe me, this young man's desperation, which first killed his self-image and then led him to take his own life, mirrors the same desperation affecting thousands and thousands of people, and missed entirely or underestimated in importance by the people around them. In fact, suicide among teenagers in recent years has reached epidemic proportions, though rarely discussed in the media. Anorexia is a chilling demonstration of the hypnotic power of negative imagination. In Battling the Inner Dummy, the authors David Viner and Dr. Gilbert Hefter describe an encounter with a 15-year-old girl, Ellen, shown on the CBS television program 48 Hours in 1998. Ellen weighed only 82 pounds and looked like a sickly child wasting away, but she was firmly convinced she was fat. As a result, she avoided meals, refused to eat, or would even purge herself after eating. In this child's hospital room, the television reporter interviewing Ellen got her to stand in front of a full-length mirror and asked her if she saw how gaunt and weak she looked. "I think I look fat," Ellen insisted. The reporter then tried fact. "But you now weigh only 82 pounds. Do you think that that is a person who is fat?" Ellen sensibly replied, "No." But then she immediately said that she was fat and would grow fatter if she ate. So, determined not to eat, Ellen would pull out the intravenous feeding needles if not closely supervised. For parents, teachers, counselors, and coaches, this should be a cautionary tale, a vivid reminder of the need to be ever vigilant for some young person whose self-image is shrinking so dramatically that self-inflicted physical harm is likely to follow. For all, it is a vivid illustration of the incredible power of imagination. A person can so magnify the importance of some flaw and of the world's response to the flaw with his own negative imagination that he commits suicide. A person can similarly so color her perceptions of her strengths and opportunities with her own positive imagination that she accomplishes the most amazing things. The Secret of Hypnotic Power. In the 1950s, Dr. Theodore Xenophon Barber conducted extensive research into the phenomena of hypnosis, both when he was associated with the psychology department of American University in Washington, D.C., and also after becoming associated with the Laboratory of Social Relations at Harvard. Writing in the January 1958 issue of Science Digest, he said, "We found that hypnotic subjects are able to do surprising things only when convinced that the hypnotist's words are true statements. When the hypnotist has guided the subject to the point where he is convinced that the hypnotist's words are true statements, the subject then behaves differently because he thinks and believes differently." The phenomena of hypnosis have always seemed mysterious because it has always been difficult to understand how belief can bring about such unusual behavior. It always seemed as if there must be something more, some unfathomable force or power at work. However, the plain truth is that when a subject is convinced that he is deaf, he behaves as if he is deaf. When he is convinced that he is insensitive to pain, he can undergo surgery without anesthesia. The mysterious force or power does not exist. Unquote. Note that his comments were published in 1958. Today, hypnosis as a tool of therapy is widely accepted and used. For many, hypnosis and self-hypnosis to facilitate weight loss makes the surgical quick fix of liposuction unnecessary. A perfect analogy to my examples of emotional surgery versus actual surgery. In these cases, hypnosis is the scalpel. In dentistry, hypnosis is used to facilitate treatment of the phobic patient with virtually uncontrollable anxiety and, in many instances, proves to be a perfectly successful alternative to the problematic solution of anesthesia. With regard to the links between childhood programming, past experiences and peer programming on one hand, and the imagination, the self-image, and the servo mechanism on the other, my conclusion is that people are literally hypnotized by their own self-images. In fact, many people virtually sleepwalk through their entire lives under unrecognized hypnotic suggestion. In Quentin Reynolds' book, Intuition, Your Secret Power, a hypnotist is quoted as saying, "Clients visit me hoping that I will put them in a trance and fix their lives. In fact, many of them live in a trance and need a dose of reality." Unquote. If you are stuck in a dark elevator for a couple of frightening hours as a child, you may still be fearful of elevators, unable to get into an elevator 40 years later. Regardless of all the safety statistics, factual information, demonstration, observation of thousands using elevators, or even the daunting task of hiking up a dozen flights of stairs, you are still in the hypnotic trance from 40 years ago. Still, a little reflection will show why it is a very good thing for us that we do feel and act according to what we believe or imagine to be true. All of this does not mean the system itself is bad. It only requires learning how to better use the system. Truth determines action and behavior. The human brain and nervous system are engineered to react automatically and appropriately to the problems and challenges in the environment. For example, a man does not need to stop and think that self-survival requires that he run if he meets a grizzly bear on a trail. He does not need to decide to become afraid. The fear response is both automatic and appropriate. First, it makes him want to flee. The fear then triggers bodily mechanisms that soup up his muscles so that he can run faster than he has ever run before. His heartbeat is quickened. Adrenaline, a powerful muscle stimulant, is poured into the bloodstream. All bodily functions not necessary to running are shut down. The stomach stops working and all available blood is sent to the muscles. Breathing is much faster, and the oxygen supply to the muscles is increased many-fold. All of this, of course, is nothing new. Most of us learned this in high school. What we have not been so quick to realize, however, is that the brain and nervous system that reacts automatically to environment is the same brain and nervous system that tells us what the environment is. The reactions of the man meeting the bear are commonly thought of as due to emotion rather than to ideas. Yet it was an idea information received from the outside world and evaluated by the mind that sparked the so-called emotional reactions. Thus, it was basically idea or belief that was the true causative agent rather than emotion, which came as a result. In short, the man on the trail reacted to what he thought, believed, or imagined the environment to be. The messages brought to us from the environment consist of nerve impulses from the various sense organs. These nerve impulses are decoded, interpreted, and evaluated in the brain, and made known to us in the form of ideas or mental images. In the final analysis, it is these mental images that we react to. Note that I've used the terms thought, believed, and imagined as synonymous. In affecting your entire system, they are the same. You act and feel not according to what things are really like, but according to the image your mind holds of what they are like. You have certain mental images of yourself, your world, and the people around you, and you behave as though these images were the truth, the reality, rather than the things they represent. Suppose, for example, that the man on the trail had not met a real bear, but a movie actor dressed in a bear costume. If he thought and imagined the actor to be a bear, his emotional and nervous reactions would have been exactly the same. Or suppose he met a large, shaggy dog, which his fear-ridden imagination mistook for a bear. Again, he would react automatically to what he believed to be true concerning himself and his environment. It follows that if our ideas and mental images concerning ourselves are distorted or unrealistic, then our reaction to our environment will likewise be inappropriate. Can these causative factors change? Certainly. Consider the child raised in an intentionally segregated environment by racists. The child could be a white person in a family of white supremacists who devoutly believe that blacks are mud people, evil, and a threat to their well-being, or the child could be black in a family with comparable hatred for whites. Either way, the child is programmed with certain beliefs that will govern her behavior. In her imagination, she constructs certain truths that would be very difficult to modify as she matures. However, some people make a 180-degree change in their beliefs and behavior at some point in their lives. These days, this has even become a popular staple of the confrontation-style daytime TV talk shows. How does a person change? Through life experience broader and more diverse than her family upbringing, societal pressure, being befriended by people of the race she was programmed to hate. One way or another, challenging what she believed to be true, discovering it is based on illusion, and replacing that truth with another truth. Now consider the child raised in a poor family, made up of people who profoundly believe that their unhappy circumstances are the fault of evil rich people and a corrupt government, who constantly program the child with class warfare ideas, and who insist that they just cannot get ahead no matter what they do. This truth may very well block that person's academic achievement, direct him away from college, have him blindly follow his father to work in the factory or the coal mine. Well, I show my age with coal mine, I suppose, yet even today the basic path of accepting poverty as fact is prevalent in many, many people. But how does one person rise out of such a background to become a highly successful entrepreneur, for example? Through books he's exposed to, people he sees on television, the influence of a mentor, life experiences, one way or another, challenging what he believed to be true, discovering it is based on illusion, and replacing that truth with another truth. Just as the Royal Knights of Spanish Harlem I mentioned earlier transformed from street toughs to chess champions, from likely criminals to model citizens pursuing adult careers as doctors, lawyers, and business persons. You can change from anything to anything by changing your self-image, by providing it with new truth. From fat and flabby to fit and strong, from mousy and timid to assertive and confident, from clumsy and awkward to capable and graceful. New evidence, actual experiential evidence, and/or vividly imagined synthetic evidence, and/or reinforcement from other authoritative influencers convinces the self-image. In turn, it relays the appropriate new directives to your servo mechanism, and a new truth exists. A new reality occurs. Why not imagine yourself successful? Realizing that our actions, feelings, and behavior are the result of our own images and beliefs gives us the lever that psychology has always needed for changing personality. It opens a powerful psychological door to gaining skill, success, and happiness. Mental pictures offer us an opportunity to practice new traits and attitudes, which otherwise we could not do. This is possible because, again, your nervous system cannot tell the difference between an actual experience and one that is vividly imagined. If we picture ourselves performing in a certain manner, it is nearly the same as the actual performance. Mental practice is as powerful as actual practice. When I first made this assertion, and when others began making it, it was a radical idea that you could practice in your imagination and achieve comparable results to actual physical practice. Today it is widely accepted, having been proved by countless trials and experiments. Athletes of every stripe routinely rely on mental or imagination practice. For example, consider Dr. Richard Koop's advice to golfers as follows. Quote, "Before you play any shot, you need to have a mental picture of how you want the ball to react once you deliver the clubhead to the ball. You need to have a definite, positive visualization of what your shot will look like. The picture should indicate the trajectory, the direction, the spot where you intend the ball to land, and how far you want the ball to roll when it lands. If the flight of a shot is difficult for you to picture, try visualizing a strip of highway that curves in the manner you wish your ball to travel. Your options in this visualization are limited only by your imagination. You might see the green as a pincushion ready to accept your shot. Pick visual images that work for you." Visualization is one of the most individual aspects of golf psychology. Unquote. Jack Nicklaus has said, "I never hit a golf shot without having a sharp picture of it in my head. First I see where I want the ball to finish, then I see it going there, its trajectory, and landing. The next scene shows me making the swing that will turn the previous images into reality." Unquote. Take note of the striking similarities between the Golden Bear's description of what he actually does, Dr. Koop's instructions, and the instructions in this program. It is important to understand that imagination practice need not be restricted to your golf or tennis swing. The same principles of mental practice apply to virtually anything, including broader behaviors, such as speaking up confidently and asserting your opinions in business meetings versus remaining intimidated and silent and regretting it later, or directly asking prospects for orders rather than leaving sales presentations hanging with wimpy, vague endings, and so on. I have developed a very specific regimen for mental or imagination practice, using what I call the theater of the mind, which I will get to later. Dr. Koop also goes on to describe virtually the same mental movies technique I first began teaching in the late 1950s and wrote about in the original version of this book. Jack Nicklaus uses the word scene. He is playing out his successful shot as a little mental movie, literally stepping out of actual play and into the theater of the mind to watch the movie, then stepping back out to experience the déjà vu effect. In a July 2000 article in Golf magazine, Jack Nicklaus said, "The more deeply you ingrain what I like to call my going to the movies discipline, the more effective you will become at hitting the shots you want to hit," unquote. In his four-step process, in step four, he even says, "Select the club that the completed movie tells you is the right one." Remarkably, Jack Nicklaus has found his way to virtually the same mental movies technique I prescribe, even going so far as to turn the pesky details of correct club selection over to his automatic success mechanism, rather than attempting conscious choice. I say remarkably, because as far as I know, Mr. Nicklaus has never read Psycho-Cybernetics, although he has likely been influenced by the many other golfers and golf coaches who have. However, it's really not all that remarkable, since it seems almost all peak performers find their way to this technique one way or another. In a few moments, we'll talk more about the specifics of these mental movies. Let me first tell you about some of the scientific documentation that supports the entire idea of imagination practice. In one of the first controlled experiments I read about, psychologist R.A. Vandal proved that mental practice in throwing darts at a target, wherein the person sits for a period each day in front of the target and imagines throwing darts at it, improves aim just as much as actually throwing darts. Research Quarterly reported an experiment on the effects of mental practice on improving skill in sinking basketball free throws. One group of students actually practiced throwing the ball every day for 20 days and were scored on the first and last days. A second group was scored on the first and last days and engaged in no sort of practice in between. A third group was scored on the first day, then spent 20 minutes a day imagining that they were throwing the ball at the goal. When they missed, they would imagine that they corrected their aim accordingly. The first group, which actually practiced 20 minutes every day, improved in scoring 24%. The second group, which had no sort of practice, showed no improvement. The third group, which practiced only in their imagination, improved in scoring 23%. This particular experiment has been widely reported and referenced, and since repeated at many universities over the years. Of course, none of this is infallible. After all, Shaquille O'Neal's problem with foul shots remains a mystery. However, while an inexact science, the use of imagination practice is nevertheless an effective science, a proven and practical means of improving skills or altering embedded truths in order to alter behavior. Mental pictures are powerful medicine. Kay Porter, Ph.D., and Judy Foster, authors of The Mental Athlete, Inner Training for Peak Performance, provided an excellent, detailed prescription for relieving pain and accelerating recovery from injury. In an article in Tennis World magazine, they noted, "An important element of self-healing is a mental image that projects a positive future outcome. This visualization stimulates your mind and body and creates an intention to heal. Through mental imagery, it is possible to alter the body's autonomic physiological responses. When you use imagination, mental pictures, and suggestion, you can communicate with your body and make it respond," unquote. Make no mistake, this is medical scientific truth, not mumbo-jumbo. If every hospital patient and every person entering physical rehabilitation were given a copy of Psycho-Cybernetics, they would be considerably better off. Keep this in mind if you ever have a loved one or friend in such circumstances. This article is so revealing and useful. We've posted more extensive excerpts at the Psycho-Cybernetics Foundation's website, www.psycho-cybernetics.com, should you care to read it or refer a friend to it. You will also find other articles, book reviews, and book excerpts directly related to this program in a special section of this website. Mental pictures can help you sell at a higher level. In his book, How to Make $25,000 a Year Selling, Charles B. Roth told how a group of salespeople in Detroit who tried a new idea increased their sales 100%. Another group in New York increased their sales by 150%, and individual salespeople using the same idea had increased their sales up to 400%. And what is this magic that accomplishes so much for salespeople? To quote Mr. Roth's book, "It is something called role-playing, and you should know about it, because if you will let it, it may help you to double your sales." What is role-playing? Well, it is simply imagining yourself in various sales situations, then solving them in your mind, until you know what to say and what to do whenever the situation comes up in real life. The reason why it accomplishes so much is that selling is simply a matter of situations. One is created every time you talk to a customer. He says something or asks a question or raises an objection. If you always know how to counter what he says or answer his question or handle the objection, you make sales. A role-playing salesman at night when he is alone will create these situations. He will imagine the prospect throwing the widest kind of curves at him. Then he will work out the best answer to them. No matter what the situation is, you can prepare for it beforehand by means of imagining yourself and your prospect face-to-face while he is raising objections and creating problems, and you are handling them properly. Unquote. I suspect Mr. Roth's book is now out of print. The $25,000 in its title telegraphs its age. But countless sales books, sales training programs, and professional sales trainers have since incorporated this idea into their methods and advice to sales professionals. In fact, if you are engaged in the field of selling, you've undoubtedly participated in actual role-playing in the classroom, in the seminar room, or at a sales meeting, and may have then practiced with a colleague or a spouse. What you may not have realized is that moving the role-playing from the seminar room to the theater of the mind can be just as effective, and arguably more effective, because you can progress from fumbling awkwardness and uncertainty to perfection and success. You can then rehearse only that drama repetitively until it becomes second nature, and your real selling experiences so closely mirror those practiced perfectly in your imagination that they are déjà vu. If you view negotiation as high-level selling, then this story demonstrates this well. It is a letter I received from a professional brought in by a company to represent it in a very complex and challenging negotiation with millions of dollars at stake, with the CEO of a public company famous for being difficult. While I cannot reveal the names involved, I assure you the letter is in my possession. Here it is, excerpted in part. Dear Dr. Maltz, since I had the luxury of several weeks to prepare for our first meeting that would take place behind closed doors, I immersed myself in preparation by studying everything I could obtain about this man. I read a book he had written, books and articles about him, watched videotapes of interviews with him from TV networks and programs, analyzed his biography, and ultimately produced a walking, talking replica of him in my imagination so that I could carry on conversations with him. I did not have means to have someone else ably act as this person in actual role-play, as politicians do when preparing for debates, so instead I created an imaginary clone. Frankly, I chose not to let any of my associates know exactly what I was doing, for fear of having the men in white coats called. My client might have had second thoughts about entrusting this high-wire negotiation to someone who had an imaginary man he was talking with for hours each day. Anyway, I followed the instructions I found in your book, Psycho-Cybernetics, as inspiration for my approach. After constructing this imaginary person, I then spent hours in what you call the theater of the mind, actually playing out the meeting and dialogue we would have, myself the scriptwriter, director, lead actor, and observer, which I found difficult at first, but less difficult as I stayed with it. Soon I found my imagined clone actively raising issues, questions, and arguments on his own. Once I recall sitting in my easy chair, eyes closed, immersed in this imaginary meeting, catching myself losing my temper and pounding my fist on the arm of the chair. As this evolved into a mental movie with a successful outcome, I transitioned into replaying that identical movie repeatedly. I even went so far, after many viewings, to write it out word for word, as if a courtroom transcriptionist was there to accurately record our conversation word for word. Here is what is remarkable. When the actual meeting took place, not only did it follow my script in order and flow, and not only did I voice things exactly as I had many times in the mental movie as you might expect, but he also performed as if working from the very same script. Unquote. In his letter, he goes on to describe a very successful outcome, the earning of a substantial fee. By the way, I received this letter in 1974, 14 years after the first publication of my book. He made mention of noting its copyright and at first questioning how relevant and beneficial such old techniques might be. You may very well be listening to this program 30 or 40 years after Psycho-Cybernetics' first edition, and even after I have left the living. It will not matter. These techniques will be used by top professionals in every field of endeavor long after the bulky computer has been reduced to a device you can wear on your arm like a wristwatch. There is now a book based on Psycho-Cybernetics specifically for professional salespeople, Zero Resistance Selling, published by Prentice Hall and available in bookstores from online booksellers or at www.psycho-cybernetics.com. Use mental pictures to get a better job. The late William Moulton Marston, well-known psychologist, recommended what he called rehearsal practice to men and women who came to him for help in job advancement. If you have an important interview coming up, such as making an application for a job, his advice was, plan for the interview in advance. Go over in your mind all the various questions that are likely to be asked. Think about the answers you're going to give. Then rehearse the interview in your mind. Even if none of the questions you have rehearsed come up, the rehearsal practice will still work wonders. It gives you confidence. And even though real life has no set lines to be recited like a stage play, rehearsal practice will help you to ad-lib and react spontaneously to whatever situation you find yourself in because you have practiced reacting spontaneously. This should come as no surprise based on everything I just had to say about mental rehearsal for sales professionals. In a job interview, you are selling yourself. You are the product and its sales representative. Like the negotiator, you may even have the luxury of time, several weeks, maybe even several months, to plan and prepare to search for a new or better position. If so, by all means use it to your advantage by using your imagination to construct and rehearse the perfect job interview so that when the actual interviews take place, you'll be relaxed, confident, and comfortable. A concert pianist practices in his head. Arthur Schnabel, the world-famous concert pianist, took lessons for only 7 years. He hated practice and seldom practiced for any length of time at the actual piano keyboard. When questioned about his small amount of practice, as compared with other concert pianists, he said, "I practice in my head." C.G. Kopp of Holland, a recognized authority on teaching piano, recommended that all pianists practice in their head. A new composition, he says, should be first gone over in the mind. It should be memorized and played in the mind before ever touching fingers to the keyboard. Practicing in the head has actually become the basis for quite a bit of modern piano instruction. Composer, performer, and instructor Patti Carlson achieved considerable fame promoting her How to Play Piano Overnight video program, in which she teaches people how to feel the music rather than learning to read sheet music and engage in tedious practice. Imagination practice can lower your golf score. Golf has become an enormously popular recreation, and there's a long relationship between golf and psycho-cybernetics. I've already mentioned the great Jack Nicklaus's mental rehearsal as just one example. Time magazine reported that when Ben Hogan was playing in a tournament, he mentally rehearsed each shot just before making it. He made the shot perfectly in his imagination, felt the clubhead strike the ball just as it should, felt himself performing the perfect follow-through, and then stepped up to the ball and depended on what he called muscle memory to carry out the shot just as he imagined it. Ben Hogan was ahead of the curve of modern golf psychology, which has become an industry unto itself and is largely based on visualization and relaxation techniques. Alex Morrison, perhaps the best-known golf instructor in the world at the time I was writing the first edition of this book, actually worked out a system of mental practice to improve your golf score while sitting in an easy chair and practicing mentally what he called the seven Morrison keys. According to Morrison, the mental side of golf represents 90% of the game, the physical side 8%, and the mechanical side 2%. In his book, Better Golf Without Practice, Morrison told how he taught Lou Lair to break 90 for the first time with no actual practice whatsoever. Morrison had Lair sit in an easy chair in his living room and relax while he demonstrated for him the correct swing and gave a brief lecture on the Morrison keys. Lair was instructed to engage in no actual practice on the links, but instead spend 5 minutes each day relaxing in his easy chair, visualizing himself attending to the keys correctly. Morrison goes on to report how several days later, with no physical preparation whatever, Lair joined his regular foursome and amazed them by shooting 9 holes in an even par 36. The core of the Morrison system is: you must have a clear mental picture of the correct thing before you can do it successfully. Morrison, by this method, enabled many celebrities to chop as many as 10 to 12 strokes off their scores. Clearly see the target and let your automatic success mechanism take care of the details. Johnny Bulla, a well-known professional golfer, wrote an article in which he said that having a clear mental image of just where you wanted the ball to go and what you wanted it to do was more important than form in golf. Most of the pros, said Bulla, have one or more serious flaws in their form, yet they manage to shoot good golf. It was Bulla's theory that if you picture the end result, see the ball going where you want it to go, and have the confidence to know that it was going to do what you wanted, your subconscious would take over and direct your muscles correctly. If your grip was wrong and your stance not in the best form, your subconscious would still take care of that by directing your muscles to do whatever was necessary to compensate for the error in form. This describes the payoff of mastering these psycho-cybernetics techniques, that you reach a point of efficiency where you can simply, quickly, hand a clear picture of the desired outcome over to your servo mechanism and let it take care of the mechanical details of making that outcome take place. Golf is such an excellent laboratory for these techniques because, unlike many other sports, it is stripped down to pure competition with yourself. Morrison's coaching of Lair exclusively with mental practice came many years before Tim Galway, author of The Inner Game of Tennis, accepted the challenge of an experiment to see how much golf he could learn just by adapting the inner game, that is, mental skills he had developed in playing and coaching tennis. He set the goal of breaking 80 while playing only once weekly, receiving no technical instruction, and otherwise relying on practice in his imagination, in 1 year or less. At that time, he played only several times a year, scoring between 95 and 105. His diary of that experiment is included in his book, The Inner Game of Golf. His book is well worth reading whether you have any interest in golf or not, as it is a thoroughly detailed case history in the triumph of mind over mechanics or technical information. Actually, the triumph of psycho-cybernetics. Over the years, I've had the pleasure of working with many top golfers and golf instructors, although professional discretion requires me to maintain confidentiality for most of them. Some engineered improvement in their performance with only this program and no other assistance from me. Here's one that is public knowledge. In 1964, Dave Stockton was struggling to survive on the Pro Tour. "Overall, I was playing well, but my putting was lousy," Stockton told an LA Times reporter. "My father, a retired pro, insisted my putting problems were mental, not physical, and he gave me a copy of Psycho-Cybernetics to read. I read it just 1 week before the PGA tournament. Then I went in, knowing I was going to win." Dave Stockton beat Arnold Palmer in that event and went on to enjoy a long and successful career. In fact, he became famous for his putting. And 22 years later, Dave won the 1996 U.S. Senior Open. The Real Secret of Mental Picturing. Successful men and women have, since the beginning of time, used mental pictures and rehearsal practice to achieve success. Napoleon, for example, practiced soldiering in his imagination for many years before he ever went on an actual battlefield. Webb and Morgan, in their book Making the Most of Your Life, tell us that the notes Napoleon made from his readings during these years of study filled, when printed, 400 pages. He imagined himself as a commander and drew maps on the island of Corsica, showing where he would place his calculations with mathematical precision, unquote. Conrad Hilton imagined himself operating a hotel long before he ever bought one. As a boy, he used to play that he was a hotel operator. His earliest successes were in buying dilapidated dowager properties and restoring their beauty, rebirthing them as first-class properties. He said that when he spotted such a property to acquire, he ceased seeing its actual condition, instead forming a vividly detailed collection of photographs in his mind of the hotel as it would appear after its makeover. By seeing what would be, he saw value invisible to others. A strong mental picture can pull you toward success even when you have no logical argument for it. Jane Savoy is one of the most respected horse riding coaches in America. In 2000, she coached the U.S. Olympic equestrian team competing in Sydney. She describes an instance in which imagination power superseded probabilities. Quote, "Take, for example, my experience at the screening trials for the North American Championships in 1989. I had a whole bunch of facts that supported the improbability of my doing well at the screening trials. I did have a top horse, Zapatero, But the other facts were, one, Zapatero was new to me and we had not had time to develop a solid relationship and real communications. Two, he was a young horse and not yet strong enough to do what was required. These facts made it difficult to imagine the perfect test, so I visualized the awards ceremony instead. Several times over the course of the day, I would find a quiet spot, close my eyes, relax, and visualize leading the victory lap. In the process, I stopped thinking about the facts, and thus prevented doubts and insecurities from creeping in. When the results were posted, Zapatero and I were, in fact, there to lead the lap of honor. It sounds incredible, and I in no way minimize the necessity for all the preparation and hard work involved, but mentally zeroing in on desired results as if they were already in existence was a significant factor in our ultimate success. It was important to focus on a positive outcome as a foregone conclusion, rather than allow my rather vivid imagination to conjure up failure pictures. My mind could then supply the means to achieve my goal by helping me to ride skillfully and effectively. Unquote. Of course, the skeptic would want to attribute this incident to coincidence or luck, but Jane Savoy is a skilled practitioner of psychocybernetics with many evidentiary incidents to support her convictions. In fact, she has utilized psychocybernetics for many years as an instructor and coach of champion riders, as noted most recently with the Olympic team. Even a single, simple, vividly imagined picture of successful achievement can be sufficient to block out doubts, fears, insecurities, and worries, and direct the success mechanism to the desired target. Full-scale mental rehearsal is even more powerful. There is simply no sensible case to be made anymore against incorporating mental rehearsal into your own daily regimen. Whether you are a pro or weekend athlete, sales professional, entrepreneur, executive, schoolteacher, doctor, whatever, the evidence mandates that you learn to use this tool and do so regularly for a myriad of productive purposes. It is fair to insist that if you are not utilizing this approach, you are operating without benefit of one of the fundamental, universal, most relied-on psychological tools of success we know of. It is much like being a carpenter choosing to operate without benefit of electric power and power tools. You could, but why? Why mental picturing is so powerful. The science of cybernetics gives us insight into why mental picturing produces such amazing results. I find that the more people understand about why this works so well, the more likely they are to use it. This automatic success mechanism within you, a highly complex automatic goal-seeking machine that steers its way to a target or goal by use of feedback data and stored information, automatically correcting course when necessary, can operate in only one way. It must have a target to shoot at. As the famous golf instructor Alex Morrison said, you must first clearly see a thing in your mind before you can do it. As stated earlier, this new concept does not mean that you are a machine, but that your physical brain and body functions as a machine that you operate. When you see a thing clearly in your mind, your creative success mechanism within you takes over and does the job much better than you could do it by conscious effort or willpower. Instead of trying hard by conscious effort to do the thing by iron-jawed willpower, all the while worrying and picturing to yourself all the things that are likely to go wrong, you simply relax. Stop trying to do it by strain and effort. Picture the target you really want to hit and let your creative success mechanism take over. You are not relieved thereafter from effort and work, but your efforts are used to carry you forward toward your goal, rather than in futile mental conflict which results when you want and try to do one thing, but picture to yourself something else. Finding your best self. This same creative mechanism within you can help you achieve your best possible self. If you will form a picture in your imagination of the self you want to be and see yourself in the new role. This is a necessary condition to personality transformation, regardless of the method of therapy used. Somehow, before you can change, you must see yourself in a new role. I myself have witnessed veritable miracles in personality transformation when an individual changes his or her self-image. However, today, we are only beginning to glimpse the potential creative power that stems from the human imagination, particularly images concerning ourselves. Consider the implications, for example, in the following news release, which appeared in 1958 under an Associated Press dateline. Just imagine you're sane. San Francisco. Some mental patients can improve their lot and perhaps shorten their stay in hospitals just by imagining they are normal, two psychologists with the Veterans Administration at Los Angeles reported. Dr. Harry M. Grayson and Dr. Leonard B. Ollinger told the American Psychological Association they tried the idea on 45 men hospitalized as neuropsychiatrics. The patients first were given the usual personality test. Then they were asked flatly to take the test a second time and answer the questions as they would if they were a typical, well-adjusted person on the outside. 3/4 of them turned in improved test performances, and some of the changes for the better were dramatic, the psychologist reported. Unquote. In order for these patients to answer the questions as a typical, well-adjusted person would answer, they had to imagine how a typical, well-adjusted person would act. They had to imagine themselves in the role of a well-adjusted person, and this in itself was enough to cause them to begin acting like and feeling like a well-adjusted person. I'm not certain what became of these good doctors and their innovative experiments. However, we know that today every aspect of self-image psychology, the very idea of self-image as steersman, and related techniques like act-as-if visualization are widely accepted and used in assisting the mentally ill, the handicapped, addicts, and incarcerated inmates involved with rehabilitation. Of course, you are probably not clinically insane or addicted to chemicals, but more likely a successful individual looking to psychocybernetics to help you do even better or to improve some aspect of your life. The fact that these techniques have become part and parcel of most therapies and treatments for people with far more severe emotional and psychological difficulties than you face or can even imagine holds out for you the promise that they can be even more powerful, fast-acting, and effective from your more favorable starting point. Discover the truth about yourself. The aim of self-image psychology is not to create a fictitious self that is all-powerful, arrogant, egoistic, all-important. Such an image is as inappropriate and unrealistic as the inferior image of self. Our aim is to find the real self. However, it is common knowledge among psychologists that most of us underrate ourselves, shortchange ourselves, sell ourselves short. Actually, there's no such thing as a superiority complex. People who seem to have one are actually suffering from feelings of inferiority. Their superior self is a fiction, a cover-up, to hide from themselves and others their deep-down feelings of inferiority and insecurity. How can you discover the truth about yourself? How can you make a true evaluation? It seems to me that here psychology must turn to religion. The scriptures tell us that God created man a little lower than the angels and gave him dominion, that God created man in his own image. If we really believe in an all-wise, all-powerful, all-loving creator, then we can draw some logical conclusions about what he has created. Man. In the first place, such an all-wise and all-powerful creator would not turn out inferior products any more than a master painter would paint inferior canvases. Such a creator would not deliberately engineer the product to fail any more than a manufacturer would deliberately build failure into an automobile. The fundamentalists tell us that man's chief purpose and reason for living is to glorify God, and the humanists tell us that man's primary purpose is to express himself fully. However, if we take the premise that God is a loving creator and has the same interest in creation that an earthly father has in his children, then it seems to me that the fundamentalists and the humanists are saying the same thing. What brings more glory, pride, and satisfaction to a father than seeing his offspring do well, succeed, and express to the full their abilities and talents? Have you ever sat by the father of a football star during a game? Jesus expressed the same thought when he told us not to hide our light under a bushel, but to let our light shine so that your Father may be glorified. I cannot believe that it brings any glory to God when his children go around with hangdog expressions, being miserable, afraid to lift up their heads and be somebody. Over the years, following the first publication of Psychocybernetics, I've been invited to speak at many different kinds of churches, from evangelical Christian to Baptist to Episcopal to so-called New Thought and Science of Mind. I've had in-depth discussions about psychocybernetics with ministers, priests, a Zen monk, agnostics, even atheists. I've had no difficulty navigating these different waters, and we have always found common ground in the basic premise of liberating individuals from their own inner, mental, often unconscious self-sabotage, and the corollary premise of individuals being intended, if not engineered, to succeed, not fail. Dr. Norman Vincent Peale had kind things to say about psychocybernetics, and he and I had several good discussions. Even though I have on occasion commented that simple positive thinking, as most people think of it, is too often destined to disappoint, as it tries to force the issue from the circumference of our being rather than to reprogram at the core. I don't think you can have a legitimate religious or spiritual disagreement with psychocybernetics.